Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
This podcast is brought to you by Plan Academy. Plan Academy is the world's leading learning site for anyone working in construction project management or project controls.
At Plan Academy, you learn construction planning and scheduling theory, how to master scheduling software like Primavera P6, and even advanced construction scheduling techniques.
Plan Academy's courses are 100% online and at your own pace. You can learn at the office, at site, from home, anywhere. Get $75 off any Plan Academy course by visiting planacademy.com/chatter. That's planacademy.com/chatter.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by JustDo.com. JustDo is a great business and project management tool we've been using here at Project Chatter.
I agree, Val. I like to keep things simple and JustDo is perfect for that. But I do know it's got a lot of powerful functionality as well. And one of my favorites is the task-specific chat.
Absolutely. And for all you slackers, don't wait for Monday. Check out JustDo.com. Now on with the pod.
Hello, project people. You're listening to the Project Chatter podcast, and I'm your host, Dale Fung. Sadly, or fortunately, you won't be hearing the soothing sounds of Val on this pod. However, we do have two amazing guests lined up and a fantastic topic. We've also substituted in our in-house general guru, Mr. Martin Curriston, for Val. So how are you, Martin? How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Dale. Looking forward to this pod. We've got two fascinating guests, one who we've met before in Michael and one who is new to the pod. So welcome, both of whom experts in their respective fields. So should be a good one today and for a treat.
I agree. It should be a very fascinating one indeed. And I think probably a sort of a collision of two different worlds, but a great collision, hopefully. Just a reminder to all of you to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts and to our YouTube channel, where you'll get some bonus bits like our pop quiz called Tenor. And if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, you can get in touch via our website, projectchatterpodcast.com. As we've mentioned in this pod, we're joined by two amazing guests, Michael Lepage and Nate St. John. Welcome, Michael and Nate. Thanks for joining us. How are you, Michael?
Mute button didn't work. I'm great. It's the end of the day, Friday. My energy might be a little bit low, but I'm really happy to be here with you guys. I was looking forward to this all week.
Absolutely. We love having you back and thank you very much for coming back. So hi, Nate, you've been substituted in for Dr. Dan Patterson at the last minute, for which we are eternally grateful. How are you keeping?
Well, I'm doing fantastic, and I know Dr. Dan Patterson was the initial wish, so I will do my best to fill perhaps one of his shoes in this interesting topic that we have, but happy to be here, very excited. So,
fantastic, and good luck with filling one of his shoes.
I know, thank you.
jokes aside, Dan sent a great recommendation of having you, and you come with high regard from him. So thank you so much for joining us on the pod. So as we mentioned, we're going to get into this with both Nate and Michael, and the topic is how technology is driving next-gen project risk management. But before we get into it, here's Martin with their bios.
So we'll start with Michael first. Michael is the Chief Learning Officer and founder of Plan Academy, an online training provider for construction and engineering companies. He's been a project controls trainer and consultant for the last 14 years and has taught thousands of students how to use a popular Primavera P6 project management software package. Michael loves to train, lead live events, and record training videos. When he isn't recording video tutorials or looking for a lag in a P6 schedule, he's probably chasing after his two sons or strumming his guitar.
Thanks for that. That's a great intro. Thank you.
Great. And on to Nate. So Nate began his construction journey working as a general laborer. After some time spent learning his trades, he went on to study landscape architecture and construction management. He later became a construction manager for a large owner, overseeing capital improvement projects. He was then recruited by one of the largest construction and engineering firms in North America, where he sat on the corporate steering committee for planning and scheduling. Nate has firsthand experience with pre-planning, baseline development, progress and execution, and closeout. He has worked on programs ranging from $2 million to $6 billion. He later became a trusted internal advisor for all things scheduling, in particular, conducting forensic analysis and providing guidance during project claims. Nate was brought over to Innate by Dr. Dan Patterson, where they co-facilitated risk workshops. He is currently the head of product for planning, scheduling, and risk at Innate. So welcome, Nate.
Thank you so much.
Wow, two amazing bios. I told you to be a great collision. So hang on tight, ladies and gentlemen, to this pod. So we want to discuss how technology is driving next generation project risk management. So I guess the obvious place is to start with technology and what is out there. Now there's a whole bunch of things happening in the world where you've got AI and machine learning and all sorts of things, but you know, there's this sort of the jury's out as to, are we ready for that? There's some exciting stuff you're doing at Innate, Nate, which I'd love to explore as well. And I'm sure Michael would too, from a planning perspective, and how that all comes together. But I wonder if you could sort of talk us around the technology and what is out there at the moment, and how you sort of that sort of thinking is coming into the risk space.
Yeah, and it's really an exciting time, you know, in terms of being in construction and specifically in the risk world. You know, traditionally, the construction industry has just really fallen behind in terms of embracing technology and then, of course, investing capital in technology. But they're slowly getting forced into it, knowing that, hey, you know, we really do need to leverage this. You know, construction projects are no different than any other aspect of our lives. I mean, it generates a ton of data. There's data everywhere. And so right now, today, there's a lot of really strong point solutions. There's also a theme and a trend going towards, you know, entire platforms, you know, beginning to end. And then this theory behind connected data. And, you know, some of this is cliche, but the fact of the matter is that we're not there yet as a whole in the construction industry. And so we still have an opportunity to go promote unified platforms, this shared data concept with the underlying target of proving project certainty. And so that integration is critical. And then I think the second thing is there's a lot of very complex tools out there. And running alongside those complex tools are very complex theories and methodologies that come in supporting a construction project. And I think that in the past, those technologies have maybe deterred some people to use them to their full potential. And so there's an effort to also simplify things that are very complicated so that you can almost democratize these risk assessments, risk workshops that have been traditionally, say, for big budgets and fancy consultants.
Yeah, no, great points. Michael, did you want to come in on that?
Well, let me say this. I like this idea of simplifying risk. You know, I've just been thinking about, like, and I mentioned to you guys, I don't have a huge amount of experience with risk, but I certainly have played with some of the risk tools. And, you know, even at the simplest level, we, you know, some of the risk tool sets that we have could just be the simple risk register, right? Where we log risks in there and we try to identify a couple things about that risk. We would identify the probability of it happening and whether it's high impact, low impact, and things like, I hate to say it, but even that risk register needs to be simplified, because I think we don't even know, you know, what sorts of things do we put in there? Is it just, because in risk planning, we think about all the possibility of things that could potentially happen. And that thing, that list is ridiculously long. So I think it takes someone who knows some stuff about risk to like figure out, no, these are the important things to focus on. And this is how we identify the probability and the impact, and then kind of even simplify that to like, this is red, this is green, this is yellow. Like, I think even people look at a risk register and get lost a little bit. I don't know. What do you think about that, Nate?
Well, I think there's a lot of validity in that. You know, you mentioned, you know, making an effort towards simplifying it. You know, one of the things that we have leveraged is this idea of capturing your historic data and building up this knowledge library that we call it, this set of data. And that data can be, and it has to be flexible enough to be unstructured. So it can be an XCR file, a Microsoft project file, Excel. And throughout that unstructured data knowledge library of things that have actually occurred, that can be leveraged by an inference engine that can go and mine that data and expose it relative to whatever the ongoing planning risk scenario is. And so if we can, you know, gather our data with what we currently have and then continue populating it, that knowledge library will do a lot of the work up front for us. It will suggest, hey, you know, we noticed that you're doing this particular operation in this particular market, in this particular part of the world. In the past, these are the things that have popped up. And these were those impacts that you were talking about, you know, this was the probability of it occurring. And taking it a step further, you know, we're also going to recommend the mitigations and those strategies that were applied to alleviate some of that risk. And so I like the comment, and I totally agree with making it simplified. And I think that might be a viable approach.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. I still love this idea of leveraging all of our historical data, like whether it be for scheduling or for risk or for whatever other uses you want. Like that is such an important tenet that we should have been looking at for a long time. And it's just now that we're starting to get into using tools to mine that data. So yeah, no, that's that I like a lot.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You know, so like, you know, I came from being a project scheduler, mega project scheduler at large companies, at smaller companies. And it really is shocking to see, you know, you put all this effort to manage and maintain your schedule. And then you, at the end of the day, get this nice as-built that tells you a story. And it's a laundry list of lessons learned, but it's kind of shocking that those just sit in a database and mainly just get called up when it's convenient. You know, we're going to do this bid estimate comparison. Oh, let's grab that one job from Canada and look at it one time. And there's just so much data and there's so much knowledge there that, you know, we have now begun to capture it. And to your point, Mike, you know, with the stuff like inference engine and machine learning, we can really make the use of that extremely efficient.
Yeah, no, very, very valid points. I was thinking, though, are we in the controls industry or PMO industry, whatever you want to define us as, just in general, not only just risk, but are we behind the curve when it comes to the rest of the world with technology? And are we playing a bit of catch up? I mean, Michael, you know, we've previously spoken on you know, when we had you first up in season one, how clunky Primavera is, yet yeah, it's used everywhere. Right. And I know that, you know, companies like Innate are coming up with sort of more slicker, sexier, easier to use, sort of interfaces and functionality. But, I wondered, do we have a long way to go before we get there, Michael?
Yeah. This is the same debate we had, right? On that podcast episode. Yeah. I think we determined that we're on the right trajectory, but we still have a long way to go, if I remember. Yeah, I know a lot about P6, so I always come back to that, but it applies to other scheduling tools, obviously, as well. You know, I think what I'm thinking about as we talk about like leveraging historical data and stuff like that is like the reason we haven't been doing it is because I think that historical data has been in a form that's not easy to use. It's not really, yeah, we have all those ASBITs you just mentioned, Nate. It's not easy for us to open them up and then to re-understand what that job was about and then to make inferences about why we were late here or what happened. Like it's that data, it's good data, but it's just not data that's easily used. And so I think if we're moving in the direction of taking that data and somehow transforming it to a more simplified form that says, look at this snippet here. This was, should have been like this and it turned out like this and here's why. Like if we can somehow get to a simplification of that data, I think then it can be, you know, used and leveraged a lot easier. But I think we just haven't been able to. And yet everybody's got gobs of data, right? We have gobs and gobs of historical projects, probably going back to 50 years of them in some cases, not all in P6 databases, but in some form or another. And it's, yeah, how do we leverage that data?
That's fascinating, though. I mean, that pod was almost a year ago, Michael, and yet we're still sitting here going, we need to catch up. But I'm going to hand to Nate because he's got a wry smile on his face going, yeah, we're catching up. So, Nate, come on, are you dying to tell us how we're catching up?
Well, so I think there's two things here. I think to respond to Mike's point, so today we are getting much better at mining that unstructured data through a variety of methods. I can tell you one of the things are codes and UDFs simply are massively used. If an organization sticks to any kind of regular structure, those can really propel the efficiency of data mining. You know, we'll get down to the level of identifying strength of matches. So we think this is a 50% strength or 90% strength. So, you know, I think there are inference engines out there now that can mine this unstructured data. I think we're there present. You know, it's much to be improved still, but I think that we can use a lot of where we're at now. As an industry as a whole, yes, we are behind still. You know, I know we, like for instance, you know, we trail the food and industry. There's studies out there that says, you know, the food and beverage industry is adopting technology faster than construction. And so that's why you don't see productivity rates necessarily changing for the past two decades, maybe 10 years at least, because we have not tipped to the point of leveraging this technology. You know, we're kind of on this plateau of these are our production rates. And that's why you can go back 15 years and use cost estimates and schedules, you know, with accuracy when comparing or using as a benchmark. And that speaks to the truth of we're not increasing productivity. So I think we're pretty close and possibly there in some instances in leveraging the data, but it's still not catching on worldwide as an industry.
Are we then also suggesting that if we can use things like, you know, the knowledge library, is that what you call it? Knowledge library, big data, that type of thing, machine learning, potentially these algorithms. Are we then saying we can drive confidence in other ways than using QSRA, for example? Is that what we're saying or not quite?
Well, yeah, I think so. You know, the whole idea of an AI assisted, and when I say AI, I mean augmented intelligence. It's to support still human cognitive function, sure, right? And the human is always going to remain in the driver's seat. But, you know, when we talk about leveraging that, it speeds up the process and creates a level of confidence throughout plans and more importantly throughout team members, where I think that we can become more efficient and spend less time worrying about the old school methods of things and freeing up more time for more meaningful advanced insights analytics, which will drive your business decisions. I don't know if I answered your question on that, but that was my comment.
No, I think you did. And I think Michael was sort of listening intently there going, okay, well then how do we apply non-QSRA, for lack of a better way of putting it, to schedule? I mean, Michael, you train tons of people all the time. Is there a common thread when it comes to sort of schedule risk and how that's applied? And is there sort of a generic way you approach it when you train people that you're kind of thinking maybe there's something different, or have you not been convinced yet with what is out there?
That's again a really good question. To be honest, I don't train a lot of schedule risk.
All right.
Yeah. My experience has been that schedule risk isn't handled so much in the construction industry. I don't see a lot of it in the construction industry.
Wow.
I hear a lot of it in oil and gas, where they really want to get their hands on the tools, leverage those tools towards their projects. But I really don't hear a lot of it in capital projects. Again, I'm not fully abreast of everything around the world. I'm have no doubt that when we're planning the Olympics, somebody's got a schedule risk analysis that's happening. But I think if we're building the high rise down the street, the 40-story high rise down the street, I'm not convinced that we're looking at, our hurricane diagrams and tornado diagrams and things like that. So, maybe that's a big gap. And even I don't see a lot of interest, like I mentioned, in even just the risk register. Like, let's do a simple red, green light kind of analysis and think about the big things that are happening. But I do think that owners are starting to be aware that some of these processes should be happening on the contractor side, but I still think there's a long way to go before there's some standardization. I feel like a lot of this conversation comes down to standardization. Like, every project is different. There's no, even though in construction we have so many repeatable processes, right? Like lifting, installing steel or pouring concrete. A lot of these processes are repeatable, but everyone is planned very differently, which I think also is a challenge of mining that data, because it's all entered in such individualistic, differing ways. But yeah, I don't have a lot of exposure to risk on the construction side that way.
That's interesting though, because we spoke a couple of episodes ago to Dr. David Hewlett, and he spoke about the various maturity levels that organizations have when it comes to risk. And he said the big premise behind it isn't really education. Well, part of it is education, but it's more on attitude and culture and behaviors towards risk. And that's quite an interesting thing though, because, I find there's still a lot of people that don't really fully understand risk. They try to sort of put a monetary value to it and try and forecast it as if it's a real thing. And I'm like, well, if you think about it, a risk is an event that may or may not happen. So if you're forecasting for it to happen, then it's not a risk anymore. So it's quite an interesting thing, because then when it comes back to what you're saying in terms of, using P6 and scheduling, you wouldn't naturally schedule for it. You'd make a potential provision for it. And I guess that's where, Nate, you come in and go, okay, well, this is where we provide confidence in using this knowledge library to inform whether or not you're within that ballpark based on previous bits of data and information to say, well, actually, shit went wrong on this particular one here, and this looks similar over here, so you might want to think about that. Is that fair, Nate?
Yeah, so, that's certainly involved in the upfront process, and I think that you described perfectly how a new risk register for a planning project can come about. I think speaking to the earlier comment on people may not understand it or maybe deterred by it, So what we've done at, and specifically at Innate, is we've built in this collaboration element that, and we'll, it's all digital. So let me just walk you through the workflow real quick. You have a project, you've pre-planned it, you've leveraged some AI, you've got your boundaries, your benchmarks, and you have a plan that's ready for review. We can now go and send out a digital invite to all three of you gentlemen and ask you to provide your expert feedback on any portion within the schedule. And so you get into this digital markup space, and you are altering your own instance of the schedule. You're not affecting the main project schedule. And then all that feedback gets captured, and it gets brought up to this review area where you can now see line by line in the schedule review. You know, Martin thought it was going to be 5 days. Dale thought it was going to be 6 days. Mike thought we can do it in 2 days. And so now you can leverage a lot of technology in terms of where is our consensus range. And it's quite nifty now. You know, we can take your three data sets and tell the computer, use those three to auto-generate the triangular distribution used in, let's just call it what it is, a Monte Carlo engine. So in a QSRA, Monte Carlo's been around forever. People use the engine. But talking about the experience, now I've taken the three of you, let's say your field folks that are intimidated by it, I've invited you into the experience. I've given you a voice. There's a record with your initials, and we can mute your input if we think you're out of whack and crazy. But instead of asking the old way, you know, give me your 3-point estimate, min, most likely in max, you know, the computer can auto-generate those distributions. So it's these little efficiencies that are eating in the simplification, where we can then focus on the human experience around this, where it's not so scary, and you do in fact have a voice, and we value your opinion, and you can see it firsthand unfold in a Monte Carlo-esque simulation, you know, in front of the group.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's inviting people in, as you say. And I guess it's the other point around risk. I mean, you know, you talk about threats and opportunities, and this is always an interesting point, I think, is it's... if you put a few people in a room, right, and you said, right, tell me what can go wrong, everyone's going to tell you this can go wrong, that can go wrong, that can go wrong. Yeah. Does that process also then encourage people to say what we can do better? I'm wondering. Or is it not something to encourage behavior, but it's just inviting input?
Well, so I think there's certainly a benefit in inviting individual people, in that they can go and assess their part of the plan. It's counterintuitive, but in their own silo. And what that does is it gets them outside of the groupthink phenomenon.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, as siloed as we want to break down, you know, as much as we want to break down those silos, this is actually an event where it's a positive thing. And so when we get them in up front, I feel like they have an opportunity to have a discussion and almost defend their contribution. And, you know, I've co-facilitated a lot of workshops with Dan, and I've done a lot on my own. And regardless of who's facilitating, there's always a back and forth chatter on, oh, you know what? I think that's actually an opportunity. You're crazy. Well, why don't we just go do this, double it up? And they say, oh, okay. And you know, I just get absolutely ecstatic when we get to that level of back and forth. And that's the beauty, and that will forever be the human part in this whole experience.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, we talk about technology, but as you mentioned, you're never going to get away from the human element. And then I'm wondering though, just, I see Michael, I see you scribbling notes. I'm sure you got a ton of things you're thinking as well, but just to come back to you, Michael, and you can answer those questions too, if you've got them. But then I'm thinking from a planner scheduler aspect, does this impact them, probably in a positive way to help them with their schedules, but how does it impact it? Does it change their role in any way, shape or form?
I think it puts more demands on schedulers. I think schedulers need to become more savvy, more interested in looking at things from different angles, at the risk angle as well. And maybe it's just that, you know, we haven't invited them to the table in some ways to those conversations. But, you know, I hope there's a software tool that does simplify this process. Or as I'm hearing you say there, Nate, we've created a tool that kind of facilitates a collaborative discussion, which I'm with you. Like we need more of that collaborative discussion. We also need to take the time to have those collaboration discussions. So a couple of things that are coming up for me is, like, I recently in December surveyed a bunch of schedulers for one of my clients and found that they were all stressed to the nines, like just super stressed with heavy projects. Now, given it's December, it's not an easy time of year for a lot of people. We also have this COVID craziness that's going on. But I think I'm wondering too, like, a lot of schedulers, I think, struggle just to get a schedule put together. Like, it can be a momentous amount of work to get a baseline put together and approved. You know, you probably have been there, Nate, right? Like, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of, submit it for approval, wait 3 days, comes back. It's not approved. It's marked up. And you got to go, in some ways, some parts, you got to go back to the drawing board. So, like, I'm thinking, if it's so much work for us to get that schedule built and also to maintain that schedule, the risk analysis piece, I understand why it gets left to the side. It's like, we don't have any cycles for it, you know? And I think we're still stuck in this traditional view of, like, scheduling is a part-time job for somebody. And in a lot of projects, it's a full-time job for people, but we sometimes just hire a part-time person to do it. And I don't know if we have the cycles to handle the, you know, the additional demands. Like, I think we need to take the time to really look at the data, to do the analysis, that kind of stuff. But on the other side, we have this tool that's starting to facilitate conversations. So anyways, that's a jumble of thoughts. I think there's a lot of pressure on schedulers. I don't know. What's your experience, Nate? You've clearly been a scheduler a lot. Were you running, you know, Monte Carlo simulations on projects before you came to Nate?
Well, so in the past, yes. But most of the time, I mean, we are seeing now clients shifting their thought where they are building in, you know, thou shall conduct a P75 Monte Carlo assessment upon tender bid. So, you know, there were those cases that I ran into, but there's some truth in that, Mike, definitely. I mean, I think what you said is really spot on. You know, outside of those exceptions, it was really a luxury to finally find some time to say, oh, hey, I'm going to pop into this software real quick and run a Monte Carlo. And I don't know what the hell it does, but I'm just going to tell people I'm doing it. I so many jobs and so much money, and I can probably count on both hands the number of times where I felt a project was adequately staffed in the scheduling department. There's no doubt there's frustration. There's no doubt there's high turnover. It's three times as high of a turnover than your traditional field engineer route usually. And I think that part of that is, you know, it's not sexy. And I think that part of it is we're not doing a job in project controls, even in general, of recruiting youth. And perhaps that there is an association there to the lack of technology embracement. So, you know, if we can come up with advanced tools that are up in the times for the younger generation perhaps there's an opportunity where we will want to get people that want to be career schedulers, career project controls, risk people. I mean, I certainly didn't leave a construction management program going, I'm going to go geek out on P6 for 10 years or something. I wanted to go build work, you know, I wanted to be a PM. And so there's a lot of challenges around the job of the scheduler. And I don't have the answer to that. I have some suggestions that I just mentioned, but you know, until we, I think, can make it sexy enough for youth and a viable career path, I think we're going to continually run into issues.
That's a good point. Really good point. I want to bring up the thing you just said. How do we make it sexy enough for youth? I've been thinking about this a little bit actually as well. Like, you know how like some industries, they have a bit of a mythology associated with them. I'll give you a really easy example. Startups. There's a mythology, the myth of the hero's journey getting to the IPO, right? You started this company at your kitchen table, you spent all your money, you know, mortgaged your house to start it, and then you took off and you went on this roller coaster ride that eventually lets you to get to some crazy success or bought or whatever, right? What's the mythology in project controls? What is that journey? Is it just, are we just attracting people to say, oh, it's a good job and it pays really well? Is it that? Because I feel like maybe the project controls community needs to develop a little bit of a more attractive story. Maybe it's you get to work on like with incredible technology. Maybe you get to work with those robots that are laying the bricks or some really interesting projects. Like, I don't know, but I feel like we need a little bit more of a mythology, because I'm with you. People end up buried in their P6 data coma for 15 years and then are kind of lost. I don't know. What do you think, Martin? You're awfully quiet over there.
Scribbling notes. I agree. I think there's a cultural part to all of this that we've just talked about. I think no one really wants to be in project controls when you're younger. You know, you don't, it's not something you kind of identify when you're at school. Maybe even when you start in the workplace, I don't know too many people who knew they wanted to be a scheduler when they grew up. But maybe technology is the way forward. It's the way to bring people into it. You know, a lot of the things we just said there around being in silos, the kind of groupthink effect during some of the risk reviews, maybe that's part of the culture. It's not enough adequate resource or time is put into this. And having technology that makes it slicker, more available, more sexy, that could be the enabler to kind of change the culture and get it into the mindset and really the hearts of people and get the schedules to then use their influence on the people and really promote the benefits of this.
Yeah, it's good. That's a good point. So, I mean, if I come in on that as well, I think the thing that you don't realize, because I think a lot of people fall into the control space, right? You don't, as Martin says, you don't sort of finish school and go, I want to be in project controls. It's, you know, it's great. But one is the awareness, I think, is, you know, what is project controls? People don't know what it is. But I think if you really understand what it can do for you, you can work on some really cool projects and not have the accountability of a project manager, right? Because I've been a project manager at one stage in my career, and let me tell you, there is tons of pressure on there. It takes a special person to be a project manager and take all of that heat, right? And you're responsible and accountable for everything, not only delivering, but for people and you know, you've got so many stakeholders that want a piece of you, and you don't have time to even breathe, because you know you're literally just reporting for a living. How do you, let alone get time to think about how you deliver something? So, you know, if you don't want all of that pressure, but you still want to be involved in some really cool projects, well, then project controls is a nice place to be, because you're doing all of the analysis, and it's not just about data, right? It's there's also, we've spoken about this, there's this people skill side to it, where you've got to be able to tell a story, convert that data into a message. And we often spoke about this on previous pods where project controls was the original data scientist, because we're always looking at data and trying to convert into what's it telling us. But now machines are getting better at that. And does that replace project controllers? No, it doesn't. It actually just enhances us. It's adding additional weaponry, right? So I really think it's a great place to be. And it's a great question though, Michael, because I do agree with you. I think the pipeline, it is a bit slim, but that's one issue, is the supply. But I also think the demand is increasing exponentially, specifically around these times where, what do governments do when there's recession? They pump money into infrastructure, right? And so there's all these projects happening, but there's no people to do them, right? So maybe the demand is one way to get people into it, right? Is to force the issue. But it's a really, really interesting topic. But one thing, sorry, I just wanted to shift gears slightly. I wanted to come back to what you're saying around risks and being sort of applied, Nate. One thing I was thinking when you were chatting about that was assumptions. Now, often people miss this bit because your risks should be based on the assumptions you use. Does the technology that you guys are working on take that into account as well?
Well, so I would say we would rely more on the cognitive human functions for assumptions. But you can break down. So there's two inputs traditionally used in the risk process. The first being uncertainty, right? Where essentially, unofficially, it's your wiggle. And then the second are discrete risk events.
Right.
And those are things outside of your control. And so a lot of the times what I tell my clients in risk workshops are, if there's any wiggle or gut feel, or not to use the word uncertainty, or if there's anything that's scalable, so 25% scope growth. I think that assumptions would be a valid explanation for an uncertainty application. The beauty about it is that with how fast you can run iterative simulations, you can turn off assumptions and turn them back on and see what that impact is into a schedule. So, you know, I guess we don't have a spot, I think, right now in the industry that just says this is the assumption and this is the effect on the schedule. But I think that it can be blended into the current technology that we have today in a totally acceptable fashion.
No, those are great points. And then the other thing that popped up, I was thinking around 4D modeling. Now, there's this notion that 4D modeling can actually de-risk a lot of, you know, what you're doing in terms of your schedule. What are your thoughts on that? And maybe we'll bring Michael in to respond after you, because it's got to do with scheduling as well. And I don't know if Primavera's got a 4D capability. But yeah, Nate, keen to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so 4D, if you look at history, at least it's my experience that 4D is historically been reserved for going and grabbing the attention of a client. So here's this cool model. This is how we're going to build it. It's at the proposal phase. Oh, sweet. I can see my crane walk through all these pipe racks and I'm excited. But there's, I think, as soon as bid and award is over, I think there's a dramatic decrease in the continuous maintenance of a model. Now, I absolutely agree with the fact that a model can be a de-risker. There's no doubt about it. Having that three-dimensional vision is massive. And not only for risk of schedule impacts, but we see it a lot in terms of safety too. You know, if you're performing overhead work over a sensitive area, there's safety issues there. So yeah, I fully support and embrace 4D technology, 5D technology. I think the challenge that we see with most users are the initial mapping process, and then the fact that the schedule can change so much, so dynamically. You can be splitting activities, splitting resources, inserting time impacts, suspending and resuming. How does that relate to the model? And so that initial map and the maintenance, unfortunately, relies on the human still, And I think that's where the industry and technology falls short today.
Yeah, no, those are fair points. Michael, did you want to come in on that?
All I want to do is say, Nate, you friggin' know your stuff. Like,
he does. He does. It's great.
I'm really interested in the 4D space, and you know, I was a little bit, when you said it's been mainly used to grab the attention of the clients, I was a little disappointed, because I think there's so much potential to have that visualization. You know, that visualization, I think, makes things real for a lot of people. You can't look at a Gantt chart and see, you know, the potential of what this project is, but you can look at that model and really see it. It's interesting too, what you said, how the schedule changes so quickly and the models become difficult to maintain. I don't know, Nate, you know your stuff, but I'm, you know, because we were talking about how technology is driving next generation risk, and that was the theme here. I was curious about talking about other technology, like maybe drones, and how some of the drone technology that's out there. I don't know, Nate, if you have any, Martin too, anybody, if you guys have any opinions on this as well. Just a little sidebar. I bought a drone because I went to a construction conference, not that, you know, last year, and there was some talk on it. I was like, oh, this is really neat. And so I have a drone, and I'm interested now in kind of learning more about how people are using it for construction. And what I understand is now that we've got drones that are able to scan and produce the models quicker. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Go on, Nate, you go first, and then we'll bring Martin in.
Go, Nate.
Yeah. So I guess in a nutshell, I think every construction project should be have drones. I think that there should be dedicated drone operators on every single construction project, not only scanning using LiDAR technology and scanning to generate models, but people are now taking snapshots daily of, you know, let's say a stockpile of spoils, and they're now quantifying, okay, how quickly are we using, you know, our reserves on site, you know, and then that triggers something in a connected data system that says, okay, now we have to reach out to this vendor and get them on notice that they're going to have to start trucking in some more stuff because we're breaching below our comfortable allocation limit. So, we talked very briefly about the challenges between model and schedule, but if you open it up for the entire project platform, that's what we're, you know, doing at Innate, and that's the mission I think that should be in the industry, is that you take everything you need, you put it on a platform, you connect it, and when the drone tells you something, it triggers off a form in a document management system. When you see an issue in the field, it goes to a potential change order, it automatically wires to the schedule, and then it flags the estimate. And so I you know, not to get off too much on a tangent, but I think drones are incredible, and they should be used on every project.
Does that exist now, that technology you're talking about? Or is that something being worked on?
All the connected stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're working on. I would say most of what I said exists now. That's the effort. There's definitely other companies out there that are taking the full project platform approach. But the unique thing is that you always have to account for specific clients. So having the flexibility also to tie into third-party entities like a P6, you know, so it's this entire platform, but it's also so customizable with what you're using specifically. You know, there's a lot of complexities. There's a lot of API integrations and stuff, but I think that clients and owners should be demanding it. I think that it's a valid demand now. And, you know, I think we're just trying to keep up with that demand.
Great. That's exciting stuff. Martin, come on. Give us your take. What's happening?
I mean, yeah, like Nate said, we know the technology works. It's working on other on real life projects. So, yeah, embrace it. You know, it's relatively new. It works. And, you know, invest in it. It can really help us. And then the things that we just talked about there, how it links to some of the scheduling tools, we can work on that over the years, and people will become fully trained and on that over the years. So yeah, just let's embrace it.
Do you have examples, Martin, of real life examples of where maybe not drones, but where you've used video footage or camera or something to inform scheduling or progress? Maybe not as interconnected as Nate's kind of suggesting, but has that happened for you?
I've seen on some of my projects where 3D modeling's been used on the underground to get around the issue of having to take out a team of four or five people and the cost involved in that each night. So having that technology has been efficient. It's taken out any of the scope for human error. It's worked on the little part of it I've seen, but I think as Nate alluded to, it's being used on kind of mega projects around the world. It's good.
No, it's great. And all the technology out there that we have, we should certainly try and bring it together. So I love this. And I know Val is going to listen back and go, damn it, why did I miss this? Because he loves technology. I think he's a Elon Musk disciple as well. He wants one of those chips in his brain as soon as he can get one. He'll even skip the vaccine for that. But that's his loss. The other one I wanted to kind of bring up, and I guess I'll sort of get your thoughts on this first, Michael. I had this sort of a few years back. I was saying the planner's role will become redundant. And I said that to my planners as well. I was like, you better upskill. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, well, in 5 to 10 years time from now, machines are going to be doing your job. You know, if you're a P6 jockey and you're just simply gathering data and putting it in and going, this is what the computer says, well, computers are going to do that better. There's going to be some sort of app or something that's going to go to the engineer and say, what's your estimate on this activity and what you're going to do next? And it's going to sort of link them all up, automatically, and it's going to provide you a schedule. And then as you progress, whether it's on a typically periodic basis, it's going to go back out and send you maybe a link via email or Slack or whatever you're using. And you're going to update your schedule by not having this planner involved. Is that just sort of me going off tangent, Michael, or do you think that's something that's a real possibility?
Good, great question. I think it is a real possibility, but not for a good while. I don't think we're going to see that for a while. I mean, we've been touching on this point throughout this conversation. It's about the standardization of things, right? Like, if we don't have a standardized template or a standardized, we can't measure the same thing over and over or produce the same building blocks that produce schedules, then we can't do that just yet, right? Like, I think that's a big challenge. And I'm really surprised that across the world we don't have more standardization on things like schedule or milestones or there probably is standardization out there, but it's not well embraced, right? So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought there was a software tool out there that already builds schedules. And I'm sorry, I saw it at a conference. I forget the name of it. But like, people are playing with this idea already of having a schedule that kind of regenerates itself and changes itself. And it's pretty exciting. There's a lot of cool things you can do in software. But yet the tool is not enough to actually generate a real schedule that you would use for a construction project. So, man, we need that though. Let's get there.
Well, I don't think it makes people redundant. I think it makes the way we do things today redundant as we evolve with technology. But I'm looking at Nate and I'm seeing that wry smile again going, we're closer than that. Are we, Nate? Are we closer? We think
so. It is an interesting concept. It's funny. I'm reading a fascinating book right now, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. It's a couple years old right now, but he's to the point now in the book where he's talking about merging infotech and biotech. And then it gets into this whole, computers taking over. I think schedule generation is probably there. Today, you know, you can select, say, for instance, particular fragments of a knowledge library, bring them in, boom. I mean, you can today create a schedule, a large schedule in minutes if you wanted to. And I think some of the day-to-day calculations and analysis is there. The question is, can computers dictate and define what creativity is? You know, there are a lot of value engineering decision-making on a project. And if you think, you know, a project starts with an owner's concept and their design. And so they define something out of a creative space. And then a contractor comes in and there will certainly be some automation, but you're always going to run into a constraint or a pain point where you're going to have human creativity and ingenuity still to at least push the buttons that can crunch some stuff for you. So redundant, probably, but obsolete, absolutely not. I don't think so for a long time.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that actually, because if you think that, well, it's an interesting mashup again, I guess, between what machine learning is and is that creativity? Because I mean, I don't understand it, right? And I don't know if many people out there that listen to this understand what machine learning might be. And if I take it in my sort of dumbed down form in my head, if machine learning is all about taking what we've done in the past and repeating it and making sure we don't deviate or do it the best way we've done it in history, is there any way to make it better than that historically? And I think what you're suggesting is, well, that's where creativity comes in, is where we improve on our previous best. Now, does machine learning and AI and technology allow us to, well, not allow us, it might allow us because it informs us, but by itself, can it naturally improve on what our previous best has been?
Yeah, if I follow your statement there, yes, I think so. But it's just going to be an elevated version of complementing the human cognitive function. So it's an increase of efficiency, but I still think that humans will be, at the end of the day, in the driver's seat. I don't think you'll see this concept of, you know, so-and-so computer went and learned chess by itself without any human inputs and now is the greatest machine in the world and can beat anybody. That I don't think that's applicable for the construction industry.
And I see Michael doing a huge sigh of relief going, I don't have to train computers. I can still train people.
Totally true. Totally true.
No, it's great. It's great. You wanted to chat as well, Nate, around, I think it was bridging the gap between contractors and clients when it comes to risk and collaboration. And how is technology allowing that to happen? Because again, this is hearts and minds, right? This is behaviors. And typically you know, if you're working for different organizations, you have different goals. And, you know, if you're the contractor, you want to, you know, be as profitable as possible under the contract. And so you may want to hide as many risks that might come up, so that you're not vulnerable under that contract. How does technology then help with that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it is something that I'm passionate about. So if we start back from where we left off with the collaborative risk assessment approach, we provided our inputs, everyone has this agreed to this consensus, and we've developed this risk-adjusted schedule. You know, every Monte Carlo or risk assessment is going to have the probability percentile value. And what I like to describe that p-value is let's call and use the standard example of a P75. I like to call that a competence level. Okay. And so the conversation between the owner and the client or the owner and the contractor, if a contractor goes and runs a risk assessment, especially with owner input, that owner can come out with a confidence level of 75%, saying, I'm 75% certain that I can hit this schedule date and this cost date. And I'm going to propose to you, Mr. Owner, that that is our delivery. And so it's more than just a schedule and cost delivery. We've introduced this third dimension of confidence. And the conversation and that really needs to be had and what we're trying to curb is that the contractor says, listen, I may be more expensive and may take a few months longer than our competitor, but our competitor is not accounting for risk adjustments in their proposal. And so what is the benefit and how much weight does that third dimension of confidence carry to an owner? There's no doubt that accounting for risk will limit your downstream impacts and disputes and claims and all the messy stuff that gets kind of pushed to the end of a project. But it's, and we're still trying to quantify that. And schedule value and added value in the scheduling world is always so difficult. How do we quantify a value of a good scheduler? So it falls into that trap a little bit. But if we can communicate that to the owner, and if the owner can accept a risk-adjusted schedule that's higher than most competitors not using this technology, if they understand the value involved and the savings involved, then we can curb that conversation where that's just kind of the norm, and it's going to end up better for both players' bottom lines.
During those conversations, did they talk about the actual monetary value of some of those constituent risks? So you mentioned the time impact and the cost impact overall, but there's some of the constituent risks, the monetary value associated with that. I imagine that can be quite an emotive topic between a client and contractor. Does that get discussed at that level, or does it sort of all get rolled up into the macro level?
I think it can. I think there'll definitely be questions around, well, why are we so bloated when our, you know, internal engineer estimate was this? But the beauty about it is that you can slice and dice this, because again, the two outputs are, what is my exposure and why am I exposed? And so if there is some contention there, you can simply go to why am I exposed, take your top contributors, and then further mitigate against those, knowing that there's going to be a cost to that, and then simply press the button, rerun your scenario, and in seconds, you now have an updated risk-adjusted schedule. So it's that quick, it's that easy, it's just, it supports the conversation to highlight what really is the benefit of this approach.
It's really interesting. But you're talking there sort of in the initial phase as well. So it's really getting it set up from the beginning, going in, you know, with a solid bid, sort of eyes wide open, right? That approach. But we've seen many bids go in sort of, you know, let's go in aggressively and optimistically and we'll win it and we'll make it up, you know, with all the compensation events going forward, etc. And hopefully that's one way to sort of come around it and say, well, actually, no, let's build some of it in. But I'm wondering, though, then how does that help with, you know, those current contracts where, you know, you have gone into a contract and you can't get out of it because it's so many millions or billions of pounds or dollars. And, you know, you're sort of a few years in and it's going to cost you more to terminate than to continue. Does that help then? I'm wondering, because if the behaviors are set, then does the technology really change the behaviors around risk management?
Well, so if I'm hearing you properly, if we catch it in execution and run the same old projects don't fail because of execution, they fail because of poor planning, which I believe is true, mm-hmm. then it will help whatever party is responsible, because you're at the end of the day still going to get the insight of what's driving. And to your point, I think projects do a really good job upfront identifying risks and accounting for risks and making whatever decision they want to go into bid. But then there's a tendency for that risk register to disappear. And, oh, you know, only when we run into a hiccup am I going to now call it up. I'm going to call it up in the 10th month of a project. Well, those risks update, progress, and mature just like any other thing in a schedule, just like activities. So now you're pulling in an outdated risk register to try to solve a problem that you created by not planning appropriate. So, you know, it's damage control at that point. But the beauty of it is that you can quickly bring it back up. You can quickly run a reassessment, and you can at least take stake of where you're at. You know, you could, you know what the problems are, and now you have to get back to your creativity in order to try to, you know, become successful.
Yeah, and we've seen some very creative ways to get back to success.
Sorry. So Nate, just quick question. Like, as you're talking about this, we're kind of like leaning towards like this risk, running these risk assessments. This is a good thing. We should all be doing this. This it works towards the benefit of both the contractor and the owner. How long does it take? What's the effort?
Yeah.
Like the way you described it, it was like, oh, you just rerun it. Yes, I believe that's true. But how long did, what's the effort to build it the first time?
Yeah. So, of course, it's project specific on size, but, you know, we've now moved from what used to be a 1 week in-person experience to this world of COVID. And that's really, Dan and I really connected, Dan Patterson and I, we connected during COVID in a virtual world. And him and I were spending usually about a half a day with folks. We commit maybe 2 hours to the estimate mapping, I guess we call it risk mapping, and then 2 hours on the schedule. Now I've done a total project in 2 hours. So there's a little bit of upfront work. The beauty about getting people out front and involved early with collaboration is that prior to the review or workshop, you can fire these email notifications to almost assign homework. Like, hey, we have a workshop next week. This is everything we need your opinion on. You know, in your own time, do it and be ready. And that speeds up the process drastically. You know, what we're able to do now is we can merge in an updated XCR file, but retain that risk mapping that was established at the baseline. And so every time you bring in an update, it just the computer remembers, oh yeah, these were the activities that had this risk. And so now it's just, it really is quick. It's update your risk register. Has any risks retired? Have we changed a mitigation strategy? And usually that's, you know, managed by a risk manager or somebody. So that'll be prepared. And essentially, yeah, I mean, you're talking about seconds to run. I think that this all goes back to that democratizing something that used to be left for big budgets and specialty to now really no excuse to not hit the run button and just incorporate this with all your other iterative process in the continuation of plan, replan, moving forward. Risk should tag along as a sibling of all that iterative effort.
Let me repose that question. So, using another platform though, not using Innate, like if I sat down and did a Primavera Risk or a PERT Master or a Safran, would it be about the same process? You said, you know, again, correct, different size of projects, different amount of effort, but like, is the variation, is it like from 2 weeks to 4 hours? Like what in your opinion, what is the range of like generating that risk profile?
Yeah. So I was a long time, Acumen Fuse user in risk. So you mentioned Safran, I'll talk specifically to Acumen, you know, great tool. And I was using that in my prior life. And you still go through a mapping process. You still can use a register. Usually they're an independent register where today you should be using, you know, a single register. So you just map one time. And then I think a lot of it has to do with you get the same reports and stuff, but if you want to commit changes and have that show up in your schedule, your risk-adjusted schedule. That's where some of those point solutions are lacking, just because they're not part of a larger platform.
Right.
And so, you know, seeing something that you like, wanting to commit it, and then going right to your schedule and seeing it there, I think is something that you might lose. You know, and that is part of the workshop too, because then you're, you know, once you make a risk adjustment committed, you're now going to look at your histograms and your resource curves, and you're going to do some leveling. Then you want to push it back over again and rerun it. And so I think maybe the upfront mapping work would be similar, but, you know, all the connected pieces beyond it, that's a huge time saver.
Okay. But if I'm hearing you right, like you kind of said up front, like you sit down with a client and it takes a couple hours to a day to go through this map, you know, the mapping and the assessment process, like that's not a lot of effort, right? Like, I think that's the point we're trying to get to here. That's not a lot of effort to have that information to help guide you towards the proper result of the project, right? To have that 75% confidence interval, P75 result. Owners, if you're listening to this, you should make this mandatory. Like, this should be mandated on all projects. It seems like it would make a lot of people's lives easier.
Have you got a real life example of a mega project where this has worked?
Yes. It was an LNG plant. And there were multiple payment milestones that had liquidated damages associated to them. And so what that and actually the project was an execution running behind, and there were at risk of slipping on some of these LD milestones. And so the beauty about software today is that you can choose anywhere that you want to assess. And so let's say there were three milestones on this project, we run a risk assessment about against all three of those milestones independently and then holistically. And then at that point, you can turn off and turn on whatever you want. You can slice and dice however you want. But at the end of the day, in that example, it was unique because we uncovered the main driver. The main risk driver was something that was not originally highlighted on the risk register. And this is actually pretty common. So again, projects do a really good job, and then there's that one risk on top in bold, in red. Oh my gosh, this is doomsday. But when you map it into the existing model and let CPM dynamically do what it does, that risk got virtually totally consumed by float and uncovered the fifth most critical risk on this job. And so in this real life scenario, they said, oh my gosh, it was actually a blessing because they had an excellent mitigation plan for that fifth risk. But the whole time they were thinking, oh, we got it. It's this one big risk. It's this one big risk. Yeah. And so, it was a big deal. It was a proud moment. We had some validation and that's a classic example. They really benefited from this thing.
We love real life examples. I mean, that even got Michael LePage sitting up in his seat going, wow, okay, I'm listening. I was just thinking, Michael, as you were chatting, when you have your students or individuals, they may not be students anymore, you know, people that are working in their careers and you're training them and it comes to risk, what is your approach to one, perhaps putting in time risk or even mitigation actions? Is that something that you can consider? Is that something that sort of you, we talked about how we've got to sort of bring planners and risk together. Is that naturally something that we sort of train our planners to do?
I'm going to plead ignorance on this and I'm going to say no. As I mentioned before, I personally don't have a lot of experience with risk. What I focus a lot on is teaching around a specific tool.
Yeah.
And one of the challenges I find here with tools is that they're very expensive. The risk tools are very expensive platforms. And sometimes they are platforms as well, right? Like sometimes they're not sold as individual tools. Sometimes they are, but you know, Primavera Risk, I think, is a $10,000 tool. Oh. So, again, please don't quote me on that because things may have changed since I heard last. But so one of the challenges, I think, is making those tools available for learners so that they can learn those tools, they can learn the process. From my experience, it's only been large organizations who have big budgets and big project controls departments that have been able to invest in those kinds of tools. So,
no, that's a fair point. I mean, I'm sure we've all seen it. You know, you've seen a risk register in Excel, right? And that could work. Does it? I'm not sure because, you know, you sometimes you go, you know, where's your risks? You know, have you considered them? And you go, yeah, okay, we've got a bit of an Excel sheet and there they are. And okay, great. And we spoke about this, as I said, to Dr. David Hewlett a few pods ago, but it all comes back down to that whole behaviors. And it's so interesting. We, you know, this was supposed to be a pod, or it is a pod, around technology driving next generation project risk management, but yet we spoke so much around behaviors, collaboration, and I don't think we'll ever depart where it's purely technology. And my gosh, an hour has gone quickly, and I would love to continue and speak for hours and hours and hours with you, gentlemen. But we can definitely have you both back for a part two. I was wondering if we could jump to a special part of this podcast where we have a bit of fun. And Michael, this would be new to you as well because we've just introduced it. So you didn't experience this on a previous pod.
Oh.
But
I'm excited.
This section, yeah, you should be. This section is called Defend the Indefensible. And it's a new feature. I'll hand to Martin to explain how it's going to work and take you through your paces.
Okay. So as Dale said, it's a new feature that we've put in for this series of the pod. We'll trial it out. So we challenge our guests to defend a ridiculous statement for 30 seconds. It's a bit of fun. It's inspired by some of the kind of brilliantly ridiculous comments we've all heard over the years. So if you're willing and both keen, we can make a start.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay with you both? Great. Okay. So 30 seconds. I'll start with Michael, and I'll do a separate one for Nate. So Michael, you have 30 seconds to defend the following statement. The best planning tool for project managers is Visio. Discuss.
Oh, Visio is so easy to use, and it makes incredible Gantt charts. There's so much intelligence behind it. I mean, you can draw arrows to boxes, and those arrows can go any direction you want, which is one of the best features. So they can go backwards, forwards, up, down. You know, projects are best described with circles or triangles or parallelograms, and Visio's got all of those things. Lots of different color options in there as well. And if you wanted a swim lane, you can even get a swim lane.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Amazing. Oh, so that's convincing great. As well.
I know. You definitely convinced me though. Okay, Nate, so you're one. You have 30 seconds to defend the following statement. I do risk management. Here's my risk register. Discuss.
Oh, well, I've taken so much time to think about my risk register. I've highlighted the name, the description, the ID, the chance of occurring, the impact probability for not only cost, but durations. Heck, I assigned it to you, Martin. And tell you what, it's due next Thursday. What more can you possibly ask for? Everything that you could possibly need, I'll even include, tell you what, an open text field where you can type notes. How about that?
Wow.
One line, what else could you possibly ask for?
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
I love that. It's amazing. It's so good. We hear these ridiculous statements and we thought, let's challenge our guests to try and defend them. And Yeah, it was fantastic listening to how convincing both of you were with those statements as well. It sounds like you've used those statements before very convincingly. So we'll let the listeners be the jury about that. But thank you so much. As I said, an hour's gone quickly and we've gone slightly over, but so much knowledge and insight from both of you, and appreciate your time. Appreciate having you back, Michael. It's always a pleasure having you on the pod. Nate, thank you so much for chatting with us and stepping in last minute. And we'll definitely get Dan back and both yourselves as well. As we round up, I just want to come to each of you just for a final thought, perhaps to leave our listeners with as we end this pod. So, Michael, you up first. Anything you just want to leave our listeners with?
I think we mentioned this point in a bring it back. Like, I'm interested in technology too, but you can see I am also very interested in the people side of project planning, project scheduling, and managing projects. So I just want to say, you know, don't forget the people side, and let's focus there a little bit as well. So
agreed. And no caps. Yes, Michael, no caps.
Do not use capitals in your schedule. Do not make your schedule all capitals.
I love that. Nate, any final thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, well, I think, again, there's a lot of complicated, maybe overwhelming theory and methods out there. But at the end of the day, everyone's marching to the same goal. And I think that, you know, the simplicity of the way things are going, I think will inherently bring people in. I think that there's definitely an open mind for it. And I would say that it's okay to demand that your data be connected, and it's okay to demand that, you know, you want to leverage these things. And I think it's okay to push software companies to do things that are cutting edge, because it's really a dual journey. So, you know, when someone says, I want to change something here and I just want it to pop up over there, well, yeah, it probably should. So keep the ideas coming. But on the flip side, also embrace what's being developed, because, you know, if no one purchases stuff or uses it, then we're going to, you know, come to a dead end. So.
Agreed. Yeah,
good point.
Thank you. Yeah, great points. And if they want to get in touch with what you're doing as well, Nate, is it, it's just innate.com?
Yep, innate.com. And you can reach out to me personally if you want. It's nate.stjohn@innate.com.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for that, Nate. We all know where to grab you, Michael. Everyone is very aware of our Mr. Primavera P6 himself, as we've called Michael before. So thank you.
I should say I'm a big fan of the podcast. That's why I sponsored it. So.
And we thank you for that too. As I said, been a pleasure to have you both on. We've gone very geeky. We've touched on culture, behaviors, which perhaps could be a bit geeky too, depending on which angle you're coming from. But we spoke about technology. We spoke about training, adoption of technology as well, and how this is influencing how we improve the way we do things, not only in the risk space, but also in controls as a whole. And I thank you for your insight and your input into that. So folks, this is all we have time for on this episode, but it doesn't have to stop here. Support our charities and access blogs at projectchatterpodcast.com. Don't forget to hit subscribe on our YouTube channel and your favorite podcast player so you don't miss the next one. A massive, massive thank you to Michael Lepage and Nate St. John for joining us, and thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Martin, it's bye for now. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.